I know the motives and priorities of my connections. I can't say the same for every branch of my government. We looked at each other for a few heartbeats. I won't try and debate this with you. Good. Now, can I have a copy of at least the photos? No. And it had that ring to it of finality. You're being childish, I said. She smiled, but it was more of a baring teeth, a friendly snarl. And you're hiding something. If it comes back and bites this investigation on the ass, I'll have your badge for it. I thought about saying, try and see how far you get, but I didn't. I was new enough to the badge that I wasn't really sure what I could lose it over and what I couldn't. I probably should look into those kind of details. I don't know enough about why Heinrich was trailing me to hide anything, O'Brien. So you say. I sighed and stood up. Fine. Have a nice day, Blake. Go talk to your connections, and we'll see where it gets you. I'll stick with the government and Interpol. She gave an exaggerated shrug. Call me old-fashioned. Suit yourself, I said. Just go, she said. I went. Chapter 38. I opened the Jeep and heard my cell phone ringing. I kept leaving it in the car, forgetting I'd had it. I slid onto the warm leather of the seats, fumbling for the phone under the seat, even as I closed the door behind me. Yeah, it would have been cooler with the door open, but I didn't want my legs hanging out the open door while I lay across the seat. Not because the bad guys were after me, just normal girl paranoia. I finally dug the phone out on the fourth and last ring before it went over to the message mode. Yeah, it's me. What? I sounded rude and out of breath, but at least I picked up.
Ma petite?
Jean-Claude made the word almost a question, as if he weren't 100% sure he'd gotten me. With the gear shift digging into my side and the overheated leather against my arm, I still felt better. Better to hear his voice. Better to know he'd called me first. He couldn't be all that mad at me if he called me first. It's me, Jean-Claude. I forgot the phone in the Jeep again. Sorry. I wanted to say other things, but I couldn't figure out how to get the right words out of my mouth. Part of the problem was I wasn't sure what the right words were.
The police have taken Jason,
he said. What did you say?
The police have come and taken Jason away.
His voice was matter-of-fact, empty even, which usually meant he was hiding a lot of emotions, none of which he wanted to share. I moved over an inch so the gear shift wasn't stabbing me, and lay on the seats for a moment. The first hint of panic was fluttering around in my gut. Why did they take him? My voice sounded almost as normal and matter-of-fact as Jean-Claude's.
For questioning about a murder.
His empty, cultured voice said it, as if the M-word hadn't been there. What murder? I asked, and my voice was getting emptier.
Sergeant Zabrowski said you'd figure it out, that bringing Jason to a crime scene was a bad idea. I was not aware you took anyone on your crime scene visits.
You make it sound like I'm visiting friends.
I meant no insult, but why was Jason with you?
I wasn't feeling well enough to drive, and the police didn't want to wait for me to feel better.
Why were you unwell enough not to drive?
Well, it seemed to be because Asher took a hell of a lot of blood, and I was having a bad reaction to having my mind rolled. It left me feeling a little sick.
How sick?
He asked, and there was a note of something in his empty voice now, something I couldn't quite place. I fainted a couple times and threw up, okay? Now let's concentrate on the current crisis. Did they actually arrest Jason?
I could not get a good sense of that, but I think not. They did take him away in restraints, though.
That's standard with any known or suspected lycanthropes, I said. I pushed myself up so I could sit on the seat instead of lying across it. The front of the Jeep just wasn't made for lying across. You do know that if they didn't arrest him, then he's free to walk out of questioning at any time.
It is a pretty theory, ma petite.
Now he sounded tired. It's the law, I said.
Perhaps for humans,
he said, voice mild. I couldn't keep the indignation out of my voice. The law applies to everyone, Jean-Claude. That's the way the system works. He gave a soft laugh, and for once it was just a laugh with nothing otherworldly about it.
You're not usually so naive, ma petite.
If the law doesn't apply evenly to everybody, then it doesn't work at all.
I will not argue this with you, ma petite.
If Zebrowski picked him up, I know where they took Jason. I'm not that far from RPIT headquarters.
What are you going to do?
He asked, voice still holding the soft edge of his laughter. Get Jason out, I said, buckling on my seatbelt and trying to pin the phone against my shoulder enough to start the Jeep.
Do you think that is possible?
He asked. Sure, I said, and I nearly dropped the phone, but I got the Jeep started. I seem to be having a little trouble coordinating everything today.
You sound so confident, ma petite.
I am confident. I was. The fluttering feeling in my stomach wasn't. I've got to go.
Good fortune, ma petite. I hope you rescue our wolf.
I'll do my best.
Of that there's little doubt. Je t'aime, ma petite.
I love you, too. We hung up. At least we'd ended with I love you. It was better than screaming at each other. I dropped the phone on the seat beside me and put the Jeep in gear. One emergency at a time. Save Jason, contact some people I knew to see if they knew anything about Heinrich, then prepare for the big banquet with Musette and company. Oh, and figure out how to keep the mess with Asher from driving a permanent wedge between Jean-Claude and me. Just another day in my life. This was one of those days when I thought that maybe a new life, a different life, wouldn't be so bad. But where the hell had I put the receipt? And could you return something that was over 20 years old? Where do you go to get a new life when your old one has you so puzzled you don't know how to fix it? Wish I knew. Chapter 39. No one stopped me at the door. No one stopped me at the stairs. In fact, people kept saying, "Hi, Anita, how you doing?" I wasn't an official member of the regional preternatural investigation team, but I'd worked with them all for so long that I was like the office furniture, something that was there, accepted, even expected. It was Detective Jessica Arnett that finally said something to me that wasn't just hi. "Where's that cutie you always have in tow?" "Which one?" I asked. She laughed at that and blushed a little. It was the blush that got my attention. She always flirted with Nathaniel, but I'd never thought much about it. Until I saw her blush. "You do seem to have more than your share of cuties, but I meant the one with violet eyes." I'd have bet money that she knew exactly what Nathaniel's name was. "He stayed home today," I said. She laid the stack of folders down on a desk, not her own, and pushed back her hair from her face. There wasn't enough of her dark hair to push back. It looked like an old gesture from when she'd had longer hair. The short, barely below ear-level cut really didn't flatter her face, but the face was still good. Triangular, with delicate bones that framed her smile nicely. I'd never really noticed, but she was pretty. Did Nathaniel ever want a date? Just date? Not the dominance and submission stuff, but like dinner in a movie. Someday I'd have the ardor under control, and I wouldn't need a pomme de sang, right? That had been the plan. So Nathaniel should, like, date, shouldn't he? If I wasn't going to keep him, he should date. I had a headache starting right between my eyes. Detective Arnett almost touched my arm but stopped in mid-gesture. "Are you all right?" I forced a smile, looking for Zebrowski. She told me what room he was in because she didn't know that she wasn't supposed to. Hell, I wasn't even sure she wasn't supposed to. Technically, this was part of the investigation that Dolph had wanted my input on, so I had the right to be there when they questioned suspects. In my head, it all sounded logical, but a little desperate, as if I were trying way too hard to convince myself. I went up on tiptoe outside the door so I could look in the little window. Television will make you think that all police interrogation rooms have huge one-way mirrors that take up most of an entire wall. Very few departments either have the budget or the space for that kind of thing. Television uses it because it's more dramatic and makes camera work easier. It seemed to me that real life is dramatic enough without the big windows, and there are no good camera angles, only pain. Or maybe I was just in a rotten mood. I wanted a quick peek into the room to make 100% sure I had the right place. Jason was at the little table. Zebrowski was sitting across from him. But what got me flat-footed was that Dolph was leaning against the far wall. Zebrowski had said he was on leave for a couple weeks. Had Zebrowski lied to me? That didn't feel right. But what was Dolph doing here? I gave one sharp knock on the door. I waited, steeling myself to be calm. Or at least look calm. Zebrowski opened the door a crack. His eyes looked surprised behind his glasses. "This isn't a good time," he said. He tried to tell me with his eyes that Dolph was in the room. "I know Dolph's here, Zebrowski. I thought he was supposed to be on leave for a couple of weeks." Zebrowski sighed, but his eyes were angry. Angry at me, I think, for not slinking off, and for making things worse. Making things worse was one of my specialties. Zabrowski should have known that by now. Lieutenant Storr is here because he's still head of the regional preternatural investigation team, and he brought the suspect to our attention. Suspect? Why is Jason a suspect? You don't want to do this in the hallway, Anita. No, I don't. I want to come in the room so we can all talk like civilized human beings. You're the one keeping me out in the hallway. He licked his lips and almost turned and looked at Dolph, but fought the urge.
Come in. He lowered his voice to a whisper, but stay on this side of the room.
I followed Zabrowski inside and went where he motioned so that I ended up at the table between me and Dolph. It was almost as if Zabrowski didn't trust what Dolph would do.
You're not letting her sit in, Dolph said.
Zabrowski squared his shoulders and faced Dolph. We asked her to help on this crime scene, Dolph.
I didn't, he said.
Actually, yeah, you did, I said. Dolph opened his mouth, then closed it in a tight, thin line. He hugged his arm so tight, it looked like it hurt, as if he didn't trust what his hands would do if they weren't wrapped around something. There was a look of such rage in his eyes. He usually had some of the best cop eyes I'd ever seen, empty, gave nothing away. Today his eyes gave everything away, but I didn't understand where the anger was coming from. Jason was sitting at the end of the table, trying to seem as small and inoffensive as possible. Since he's not much taller than I am, he was doing a good job of it. Zabrowski shut the door and sat on the side of the table close to Dolph, leaving me the chair farther away. I didn't sit.
Why did you pull Jason in?
He's got defensive wounds on his body consistent with the crime.
You don't actually believe that Jason was involved in that, I searched for a word.
Slaughter, do you?
He's a werewolf, and he's got defensive wounds, Dolph said. If he didn't rape our Vic, then he raped somebody.
You're here to observe, Lieutenant, Zabrowski said, but his face said plainly that he would have rather been anywhere than sitting here, telling Dolph to mind his own business. Dolph started to say something, then stopped himself by force of will alone.
Fine, fine, Sergeant. Carry on. Those last two words held more heat than a forest fire.
Wait, I said. Did you say rape?
We found some semen at the first murder site.
The crucifixion? I asked.
No, Dolph said harshly. The woman who was ripped apart.
Semen doesn't mean rape at a scene like that, just that he enjoyed himself.
It's sick, but it doesn't necessarily mean true sexual contact. I saw the body. There wasn't enough left of her to know whether he touched her like that or not.
I had a thought. An awful thought. Please tell me you don't mean the head.
Zabrowski shook his head.
No. Scattered over the scene.
It was almost a relief. Almost.
So why did Dolph say rape?
There was little more left of the second female Vic, Zabrowski said.
I looked at him.
I don't remember being notified about a second attack.
You didn't need to know, Dolph said. You were right. I called you in on the first one, but I didn't make the same mistake twice.
I ignored Dolph as best I could and looked at Zabrowski. He mouthed, later.
Fine. Zabrowski would fill me in when we had some non-Dolph time.
Fine. Great. I couldn't do anything about the psycho shapeshifter we had running around town. Not right that second, but I might be able to do something about the current disaster.
What did Jason say when you asked him where he got scratched up?
Said a man doesn't kiss and tell, Zabrowski said. Even I thought that one was lame.
I looked at Jason. He shrugged, as if to say, what was I supposed to say? He knew me well enough to know I wouldn't want him talking out of school. He was right on that. So I didn't want Zabrowski and Dolph to know. Hell, I didn't want anyone to know. But my embarrassment wasn't worth Jason getting locked up. I sighed and spoke the truth. The scratches aren't defensive wounds.
He's cut up, Anita, and we got Polaroids to prove it, Zabrowski said.
Dolph noticed some scratches at the first scene. They're gone, but now he's got fresh wounds.
I cut him up.
My voice sounded bland, because I was fighting to sound bland. Dolph gave a sound that was more of a snort than laugh. No words were needed to say he didn't believe me. Zabrowski said his out loud.
Shop it somewhere else, Anita. We're not buying.
I raised the sleeves on my shirt and showed my own healing scratches. When I was afraid I'd hurt him more, I scratched myself.
Zabrowski's eyes went wide.
Jesus, Blake, you always this rough?
You'll never find out, Zabrowski.
If that's a yes, then I'm okay with that. He almost touched some of the deeper scratches on my arm, then stopped and almost touched the scratches on Jason's arm. I hope the sex was good. Jason looked down at the tabletop and did his best impression of an aw shucks look. He managed to look coy and pleased with himself all at the same time. That's answer enough, I said. Jason flashed me a grin that made his baby blues sparkle. Whatever you say, mistress. I gave him a very mean look that didn't dim his enjoyment one bit. Dolph pushed away from the wall to peer over the table at my arm. I don't buy this, Anita. Maybe you scratched your own arms up on the way here to give him an alibi. The scratches aren't that fresh, Dolph. He started to grab my arm, but I stepped out of reach. I don't want to be manhandled again. Thanks anyway. He leaned across the table at me, and Jason began to ease his chair back, as if he didn't want to be in the middle. You're lying, Dolph said. A shapeshifter heals anything but silver and wounds from another monster real quick. You taught me that, Anita. He should have healed by now, if you really were the one who hurt him. Wouldn't that same logic dictate that if the scratches were from the female victim, then they'd already have healed? Not if they came from the second victim. Dolph slapped that bit of information down, as if it were a blow, and in a way, it was. I looked at Zabrowski. I can't debate the healed scratches thing if I don't know the timeline. I need a time. He opened his mouth, but Dolph answered, Why? So you can give a perfect alibi? Gee, Zabrowski, I don't see your hand up Dolph's ass, but it must be because every time I ask you a question, the answer comes out of his mouth. I was leaning across the table now, too. His scratches are older than yours, Anita, Dolph said, voice almost a growl of his own. More healed. You'll never prove in court that they happened at the same time. He's a shapeshifter. He heals faster. I taught you that, remember? Are you really admitting that you fucked him? Dolph said. I was too angry to flinch at his choice of words. I prefer the term made love to fucked, but yeah, we did the nasty. If that was true, the marks would have healed completely by now. If you're only human, like you keep telling me. The headache between my eyes felt like something was trying to stab its way out of my skull. I really wasn't in any mood for this. What I am or what I'm not is none of your damn business, but what I'm telling you is that I marked him up in the heat of passion. More than that, chances are good he was with me when the second murder took place. We can give you times if you want. Times would be good. Zabrowski had scooted his chair a little farther down the table, but he hadn't deserted his post. He'd stayed closer to all that quivering rage than most people would have. I had to think about it, but I managed to give him approximate times for the last 2 days. Truthfully, I wasn't much good on alibying Jason for the first murder, but on the second, I was pretty sure I had him covered. Zabrowski was doing his best to give blank cop face while he wrote down what I said. The entire interview was being recorded, but Zabrowski, like Dolph, liked to write things down. I hadn't really thought about it before, but Zabrowski might have learned that habit from Dolph. Dolph stayed standing near the table, looming over all of us, as I spoke. Zabrowski asked small questions to nail the times as clearly as possible. Jason stayed as quiet and as still as he could through all of it, his hands clasped together on the table, head down, eyes taking small, quick glances at all of us, without moving his head or body. He reminded me of a rabbit hiding in the long grass, hoping that if he just stayed quiet long enough, still enough, that the dogs wouldn't find him. The analogy should have been laughable. I mean, he was a werewolf, but it wasn't funny, because it was accurate. Being a werewolf didn't protect you from the human laws. Most of the time it hurt you. Sometimes it even got you killed. We weren't in that kind of danger yet, but that could change. A shapeshifter accused of murdering a human got a speedy trial and an execution. If a shapeshifter was declared rogue, one that was actively hunting humans, and the police couldn't capture it, then you could get a court order of execution, just like for a vampire. It worked almost the same way. A vampire that was suspected of a murder, but was still eluding capture and deemed a danger to the public, could have an order of execution issued by a judge. Once you had the order of execution in hand, you could kill it when you found it. Just insert shapeshifter for the vampire into the formula, and it worked the same way. There was no trial, no anything, just hunt it down and kill it. I'd done a few jobs like that, not many, but a few. There had been a movement a few years ago to make magic using humans subject to orders of execution, but too many human rights organizations had kicked a fit. As a magic using human, I was happy. As someone who had executed people on orders of the court, I wasn't sure how I would have felt about hunting a human being down and killing them. I'd killed humans before when they threatened my life, or the lives of those I held dear, but self-defense, even proactive self-defense, wasn't quite the same thing. A human witch or wizard got a trial, but if they were convicted of using magic for murder, it was an automatic death sentence. 99% of the time, the witch or wizard was convicted. Jurors didn't like the idea of people who could kill by magic walking around free. One of my goals in life was to stay the hell out of a courtroom. I knew Jason hadn't done anything wrong, but I also knew enough about the way the system worked to know that for those of us who weren't exactly human, sometimes innocence didn't matter much. "Can anyone else verify these times?" Zabrowski asked. "A few people, yeah," I said. "A few people," Dolph said. He looked disgusted, and I didn't understand this emotion either. "You don't even know who the father is, do you?" That made me give him a deer in the headlights blink. "I don't know what you mean." He gave me a look, as if I'd already lied to him. "Detective Reynolds told us her little secret." I looked at him across the table. He was still leaning over, and I was still standing, so we were almost eye to eye. "So?" He gave a sound between a snort and a cough. "She wasn't the only one who passed out at the murder scene, and she wasn't the only one who threw up." He looked as if he'd made a great point, driven it home with a surgeon's precision. I frowned and blinked at him. "I'm sorry. What are you talking about?" I let myself look as confused as I felt. "Don't be coy, Anita. You're not good at it." "I'm not being coy, Dolph. You're making no fucking sense." Then an idea popped into my head, but that couldn't be it. Dolph wouldn't think. I looked at him and thought, maybe he would think that. "Are you implying that I'm pregnant?" "Implying no." I relaxed a little. I shouldn't have. "I'm asking, do you know who the father is, or have there been too many to guess?" Zabrowski stood, and he was close enough to Dolph that it forced him to move a little away from the table. "I think you should go now, Anita," Zabrowski said. Dolph was glaring at me. I should have been angry, but I was too surprised. "I've thrown up at murder scenes before." Zabrowski moved a little back from the table. He had a resigned look on his face, like someone who saw the train coming down the track and knew nobody was going to get off in time. I still didn't think things were that bad. "You've never passed out before," Dolph said. "I was sick, Dolph. Too sick to drive myself." "You seem fine now," he said, voice low and rumbling, filled with that anger that seemed always just below the surface lately. I shrugged. "I guess it was just one of those viruses. It wouldn't have anything to do with the fang mark on your neck, would it?" My hand went up to it. Then I forced myself not to touch it. Truthfully, I'd forgotten about it. "I was sick, Dolph. Even I get sick. Have you been tested for Vlad syndrome yet?" I took in a deep breath, let it out, then said, "Fuck it." Dolph wasn't going to let this one go. He wanted to fight. I could do that. Hell, a nice, uncomplicated screaming match sounded almost appealing. "I'll say this once. I am not pregnant. I don't care if you believe me, because you're not my father, you're not my uncle, my brother, or anything. You were my friend, but even that's up for grabs right now." "You're either one of us, or you're one of them, Anita." "One of what?" I asked. I was pretty sure of the answer, but I needed to hear it out loud. "Monster," he said, and it was almost a whisper. "Are you calling me a monster?" I wasn't whispering, but my voice was low and careful. "I'm saying that you're going to have to choose whether you're one of them or one of us." He pointed to Jason when he said them. "Did you join Humans Against Vampires or some other right-wing group, Dolph?" "No, but I'm beginning to agree with them." "The only good vampire is a dead one, is that it?" "They are dead, Anita." He took that step closer that Zabrowski's moving had given him. "They are fucking corpses that don't have enough sense to stay in their godforsaken graves. According to the law, they're living beings with rights and protection under the law. Maybe the law was wrong on this one." Part of me wanted to say, "You know that this is being recorded." Part of me was glad he'd said it. If he came off sounding like a bigoted crazy, then it would help keep Jason safe. The fact that it wouldn't help Dolph's career did bother me, but not enough to sacrifice Jason. I'd like to save all my friends, but if someone is bent on self-destruction, there's only so much you can do. You can't shovel other people's shit for them, not unless they're willing to pick up a shovel and help. Dolph wasn't helping. He got down low, hands flat to the table, and pushed his face into Jason's. Jason moved back as far as he could in the chair. Zabrowski looked at me, and I gave wild eyes. We both knew that if Dolph touched a suspect the way he touched me earlier, his career was well and truly over. It looks so human, but it's not, Dolph said. I didn't like the use of it for one of my friends.
Did you really let him touch you?
Him. See, even if you hate the monsters, it's hard to keep straight in your own head what's an it and what's a him.
Yes, I said. Zabrowski was moving around Dolph, trying to get to Jason, to get between them, I think. Dolph turned to look at me, still bent over low, way too close to Jason for anyone's comfort.
And the bite mark on your neck? Was that the bloodsucker you're fucking?
No, I said. That's a new one. I'm fucking two of them now. He staggered, almost as if he'd taken a blow.
He leaned heavily on the table, and just for a second I thought he'd fall into Jason's lap, but he recovered himself with a visible effort.
Zabrowski touched the big man's arm.
Easy there, Lieutenant.
Dolph let Zabrowski sit him down. He made no reaction when the sergeant eased Jason out of the chair and farther away from Dolph.
Dolph wasn't looking at them. His pain-filled eyes were all for me.
I knew you were coffin bait. I didn't know you were a whore.
I felt my own face go hard and cold. Maybe if I hadn't been so tired, so stressed. But there was no real excuse for what I said next. Except, Dolph had hurt me, and I wanted to hurt him.
How's that grandchildren problem coming, Dolph? You still got a vampire for a soon-to-be daughter-in-law?
I felt Zabrowski react to the news, and knew in that moment that only I had known.
You really shouldn't piss off people you've confided in, Dolph.
The moment I said it, I wished I hadn't, but it was too late, too fucking late. He came up out of the chair, hands under the table, and upended it with a tremendous crash onto the floor. We all scattered. Zabrowski stood in front of Jason against the far wall. I took a corner near the door. Dolph trashed the room. There was no other word for it. The chairs hit the walls. The table followed. He finally picked up one chair and seemed to take a special grievance against it. He smashed the metal chair against the floor, over and over. The door to the interrogation room opened. Police filled the door, guns drawn. I think they expected to see a rampaging werewolf. The sight of a rampaging Dolph stopped them dead in the doorway. They'd have probably cheerfully shot the werewolf, but I don't think they wanted to shoot Dolph. Of course, no one volunteered to arm wrestle him either. The metal chair folded in upon itself, and Dolph collapsed to his knees. His harsh breathing filled the room, as if the walls themselves were breathing in and out. I went to the door and chased everyone back, and I said things like, "It's okay! He'll be fine. Just go." I wasn't sure he'd be okay, or fine, but I really did want them to go. No one needs to see their lieutenant lose it. It shakes their faith in him. Hell, my faith wasn't doing all that well. I close the door behind them and look across the room at Zabrowski. We just stared at each other. I don't think either of us knew what to say, or even what to do. Dolph's voice came as if from deep inside him, as if he had to pull it up hand over hand like a bucket in a well.
"My son's going to be a vampire."
He looked at me with a mixture of such pain and anger that I didn't know what to do with it.
"You happy now?" he asked.
I realized that there were tears drying on his face. He cried as he destroyed everything. But he wasn't crying as he said,
"My daughter-in-law wanted to bring him over, so he'd be 25 forever."
He made a sound that was halfway between a moan and a scream. Saying I was sorry didn't seem to be enough. I couldn't think of anything that would be enough. But sorry was all I had to offer.
"I'm sorry, Dolph."
"Why?"
"Why, sorry. Vampires are people, too."
The tears started again, silent. You'd never have known he was crying if you hadn't been looking directly at him. "Yeah, I'm dating a bloodsucker, and some of my friends don't have a pulse, but I still don't approve of bringing humans over." He looked up at me, and the pain was flooding over the anger. It made his eyes harder and easier to meet all at the same time.
"Why? Why?"
I didn't think he was really asking me why. I believed what I believed about vampires. I think it was a universal cry of, "Why me? Why my son, my daughter, my mother, my country, my home? Why me? Why isn't the universe fair? Why doesn't everybody get a happy ending?" I had no answer for that why. I wish to God I did.
I answered the implied why, because I couldn't answer the more painful questions. I don't know anymore. But I do know that it creeps me out every time I meet someone I knew first as a live human, then as a dead vampire. I shrugged. It just seems, I don't know, unnerving. He gave a big hiccuping sob. Unnerving. He half laughed and half cried. Then he covered his face with his hands and he gave himself over to crying. Zabrowski and I just stood there. I don't know which of us felt more helpless. He walked carefully around the room, bringing Jason with him. Dolph sensed the movement and said, "He goes nowhere." "He had nothing to do with this," I said. Dolph wiped at his face angrily. "You haven't alibied him for the first murder. You're looking for a serial killer. If a suspect is cleared of one of the crimes, then he's usually innocent of all of them." He shook his head stubbornly. "We can keep him 72 hours, and we're going to." I looked around the destroyed room, met Zabrowski's eyes, and wasn't sure Dolph had enough clout to make those kinds of pronouncements anymore. "The full moon is in a few days," I said. "We'll put him in a secured facility," Dolph said. Secured facilities were run by the government. There were places where new lycanthropes could go to be sure of not accidentally hurting anyone. The idea was that you'd stay until you got control of your beast, then they'd let you out to resume your life. That was the theory. The reality was that once you were signed in, voluntarily or otherwise, you almost never got out. The ACLU had started the years of court battles it would take to get them outlawed or made unconstitutional. I looked at Zabrowski. He stared at me with sort of a growing horror and weariness. I wasn't sure he had the juice to keep Jason out of permanent lockup if Dolph pushed. This couldn't be happening. I couldn't let it happen. I looked back at Dolph. Jason has been a werewolf for years. He has perfect control over his beast. Why send him to a secured facility? "He belongs in one," Dolph said, and the hatred had chased back the pain. "He doesn't belong in lockup, and you know it." Dolph just glared at me. "He's dangerous," Dolph said. "Why? He's a werewolf, Anita." "So he needs to be locked up because he's a werewolf?" "Yes." Zabrowski looked ill. "Locked up just because he's a werewolf?" I said it. I wanted him to hear what he was saying, to disagree, to come to his senses, but he didn't. "Yeah," he said, and he said it on tape, evidenced, untakebackable. It could and probably would be used against him. There was nothing I could do to help Dolph, but I knew in that moment that Jason wouldn't be going to a secured facility. Half of me was relieved. Half of me was so scared for Dolph that I could taste metal on my tongue. Zabrowski went for the door, pushing Jason ahead of him. "We'll give you a few minutes alone, Lieutenant." He motioned at me with his hand. Dolph didn't try and stop us. He just knelt there, face shocked, as if he'd finally heard his words, finally realized what he might have done. We all went out the door, and Zabrowski closed it firmly behind us. Everyone in the squad room was looking at us. They tried not to be, but everyone had found something to do to keep them close at hand. I'd never seen so many detectives so eager to do paperwork at their desks, or even somebody else's, as long as the desk was close to the hallway. Zabrowski looked at the near wall of people and said, "Break it up, people! We don't need a crowd." They all looked at each other, as if asking, should we move? Should we listen to him? They would have moved without question for Dolph, but finally they did move, drifting off in ones and twos to other parts of the big room. The ones who were at their desk close to the action seemed to remember phone calls they needed to make. Zabrowski bent close to me and spoke, "Take Mr. Schuyler with you and go." "What'll Dolph say?" I asked. He shook his head. "I don't know, but I know that Mr. Schuyler here doesn't deserve to go to one of those facilities." "Thanks, Sarge," Jason said, and he smiled. Zabrowski didn't smile back, but he did say, "You're a pain in the ass sometimes, Schuyler, and you're a furball, but you aren't a monster." They had one of those guy moments. Women would have hugged, but they were men, which meant they didn't even share a handshake. "Thanks, Zabrowski." Zabrowski gave a weak smile. "Good to know I'm making somebody happy today." He turned back to me. We looked at each other. "What's going to happen to Dolph?" I asked. He looked even more solemn, which, considering he'd looked downright depressed before, said a lot. "I don't know." Dolph had said enough on tape to lose him his job if it got out. Hell, if the head of RPIT was this prejudiced, it might bring all their cases under review, going back to the beginning. "Make sure he takes 2 weeks off of personal time, Zabrowski. Keep him out of here." "I know that," he said. "Now." I shook my head. I'm sorry. Of course you do. Just go now, Anita. Please go. I touched Zabrowski's arm. Don't go back in there without some backup, okay? Perry told me what Dolph did to you the other day. Don't worry. I'll be careful. He glanced back at the closed door. Please, Anita, go before he comes out. I wanted to say something, something comforting or helpful, but there wasn't anything. The only helpful thing I could do was leave. So we did. Leaving felt cowardly. Staying would have been stupid. When it's a choice between being cowardly or stupid, I choose stupid every single time. Today, I opted for the better part of valor. Besides, I wasn't sure that Dolph might come out of the room like some rampaging bull and try to attack Jason or me. We might be able to hush it up in the interrogation room, but if he trashed the entire squad room, it would mean the end of his career. Right now, he maybe had shot his career in the foot, even probably. But maybe and probably were better than certainly. I left Zabrowski to pick up the pieces, because I didn't know how. I was so much better at destroying things than fixing them. Chapter 40. Jason leaned his head back against the passenger seat of the Jeep. His eyes were closed, and he looked weary. There were hollows under his eyes, even with them closed. Jason was fair-skinned, not pale. He didn't tan dark, but nicely golden. Today he looked vampire pale, and his skin gave the illusion that it was too thin, as if some great hand had been rubbing around his eyes and across his face, rubbing him down like you'd worry a pebble in your hand. "You look like shit," I said. He smiled without opening his eyes. "You sweet talker." "No, I mean it. You look terrible. Are you going to be okay about tonight, the banquet, and everything?" He opened his eyes enough to slide his gaze towards me. "Do I have a choice? Do any of us really have a choice?"
"Put it that way."
"No, I guess not." My voice suddenly sounded tired, too. He smiled again, his head still back against the seat, eyes almost closed. "If the lieutenant hadn't popped a major gasket, would I be on my way to a secured facility right now?" I buckled myself into the driver's seat and started the Jeep. "You didn't answer me," he said, voice low but insistent. I put the Jeep in gear. "Maybe. I don't know. If Dolph hadn't been popping a major gasket, as you put it, then he'd never even thought of putting you in a facility." I eased out of the parking area. "But he might have called you in for questioning." "You are pretty scratched up, and you are a werewolf," I shrugged. He stretched his arms out over his head, arching his body against the seat, stretching all the way to his toes. It was an oddly graceful gesture. The movement flashed the cuts on his arms, making his t-shirt sleeves ride up, and he added a writhing movement, like a shudder, or a wave that flowed from the tip of his fingers down his arms, his chest, the arch of his neck, his waist, the ripeness of his hips, down the muscles of his thighs, to his calves, to his toes. A loud honking and screech of brakes brought me back to the road, and the fact that I was driving. I managed not to hit anyone, but it was close. I threaded my way through a forest of rude gestures and Jason's laughter. "I feel better now," he said, laughter still thick in his voice. I glanced at him, frowning. His blue eyes were sparkling, his face suddenly glowing with glee. I struggled, but finally had to smile back. Jason had always been able to do that to me, make me smile when I didn't want to. "What's so damn funny?" I said, but there was an edge of laughter in my voice that I couldn't quite swallow. "I was trying to flirt, and it worked. You've never reacted to my body before, not even when I was naked." I concentrated on the road, really, really hard, while the blush burned my face. He chortled. "You're blushing for me. Oh, God, yes. Keep it up, and you're going to piss me off." I turned on to Clark and headed for the circus. "You don't get it, do you?" He looked at me, and I couldn't read the look on his face. Puzzlement, delight, and something else. "Get what?" I asked. "I'm not invisible on your guy radar anymore." "What?" "You notice men, Anita, but you never noticed me. I was beginning to feel like the court eunuch." I gave him a quick frown before turning back to the road. I did not want to risk another near miss. I'd had my adrenaline rush for the day. "Come on, you know what I mean." I sighed. "Maybe. Maybe it's because you don't do casual sex, but it means more to you than just fucking, even with the ardor on." If I had been standing, I would have shuffled my feet. I had to settle for concentrating really hard on my driving. "If you got a point to make, Jason, make it." "Don't get all grumpy on me, Anita. My point is that even if we never touch each other again, I'm on your radar screen now. You see me. You really see me. He looked deeply content. I was confused. When I'm confused, I usually try to concentrate on work. Do you think the lycanthrope that's raping and killing these women is local? I know he's not, Jason said. I looked at him, because he sounded so positive. How can you be that sure? It was a werewolf. It wasn't one of our pack. There are no werewolves in the St. Louis area that are not part of the Thronus Roke clan. How do you know it was a werewolf? It could have been any of a dozen types of half-men predators. It smelled like wolf, he frowned at me. Didn't you smell it in the house? Mostly, all I smelled was blood, Jason. Well, sometimes I forget you're not one of us yet. Is that a compliment or a complaint? He grinned. Neither. How can you be so sure it wasn't one of our werewolves? It didn't smell like pack. Forget that I am human, and my nose isn't 400 times more sensitive and scent discriminating, and explain it to me simply. My nose in human form isn't as good as my nose in wolf form. The world is so alive. Scenting is almost like sight. If you've never experienced it, it's hard to explain. But in human form, touch is probably secondary to sight. In wolf form, scent is secondary to sight, or in some cases, ahead of it. Okay, say that so. What does that mean for this investigation? It means I know the killer is a werewolf, and I know he's not one of ours. Your opinion won't fly in court, I said. I didn't think it would. Honest, I would have mentioned what I smelled in the house sooner if I hadn't assumed you smelled it too. He looked worried now and suddenly younger because of it, all schoolboy charm. What he'd said got me thinking. Most breeds of scent hounds won't track a werewolf, or any weird animal for that matter. They go all shit-face, howling and whining and freaking out. They basically tell the hunters, you're on your own, I said. I knew dogs didn't like us, but I didn't know they didn't like us that much. Depends on the breed of dog. But most dogs don't want to mess with you guys. I can't say I blame them. So I guess going down to the local pound and picking out a dog is out then. Yeah, you'd set the place on its ear. Okay, do you have a point? He asked, and he grinned again. Yes. Could a werewolf in wolf form track this killer? Jason thought about that, face all serious again. Probably, but I don't think the police will go for that. They don't like us much either. Probably they won't, but I'll float it by Zabrowski when he calls. You're sure he's going to call? Yes. Why? Because we've got two dead women and it's probably all over the media. If you watch television, read a newspaper occasionally, or even listen to the radio, you might know these things, Jason said. Probably true. There's heat to solve this crime, this case, and more innocent lives at risk. Zabrowski will call because they're grasping at straws or they wouldn't have brought you in. If Dolph had a more promising lead, even out of his head like he is, he wouldn't have been busting your chops, or mine. You're sure of that? He's a cop, above all else. If he had anything else to chase, he'd have been out chasing it, not wasting time with you. I don't know, Anita. I didn't see much of a cop left today. He seems like a man who's let his personal problems eat everything else. I would have argued if I could have, but I couldn't. I'll mention the idea to Zabrowski. If they get desperate enough, they may go for it. How desperate would they have to be? I turned the Jeep into the parking lot of the circus. Maybe two more bodies, maybe three. Using a werewolf to track a werewolf might appeal to Zabrowski's sense of humor, but getting the upper brass to agree to it would be the problem. Two more women? Maybe three? Jesus, Anita. Why not try the desperate measures before things get so damn bad? The police are like most people, Jason. They don't like thinking outside the box. Using a werewolf in animal form as a sort of preternatural scent hound is way outside the freaking box. Maybe, he said, but I smelled what was upstairs, Anita. So much blood, so much meat. A human being shouldn't be reduced to meat and blood. Aren't we all just food on the hoof? I tried to make a joke of it, but Jason looked offended. You of all people should know better than that. Maybe, I said, feeling my own smile slip away from my face. Okay, I'm sorry. No offense meant, but I've had too many shapeshifters threaten me to have any illusions about where I am on the food chain. And there are an awful lot of shapeshifters that still believe that they are at the top. I don't buy that radical crap about us being at the top of the evolutionary ladder, Jason said. If we were really the perfection of evolution, why have we been around for thousands of years? But yet, you poor humans outnumber us, and usually outkill us.
I parked near the back door and turned off the engine. Jason opened his door but said, over his shoulder as he was getting out,
"Don't fool yourself, Anita. Plain old humans kill more of us than we'll ever kill of them."
He smiled, but not like it was funny. "They even kill more of each other than we kill of them." He was striding across the parking lot. He never looked back. I had offended Jason. Until that moment, I hadn't been sure it was possible to offend him. Either he was growing up, or I was getting less diplomatic. Since I couldn't possibly get less diplomatic than usual, Jason must have been growing up. For the first time in a while, I wondered if he would always be content to be Jean-Claude's laugh wolf, an appetizer, and stripper, too. But you can't strip and feed the vampires forever, can you?
Chapter 41. Bobby Lee met me at the door. Tall, light-haired, and almost shiny compared to the dim storeroom behind him. But his mood was not shiny. "The police should have let me stay with you."
"I don't think they believed my story about making you all deputies."
"You should have just said that we were all your bodyguards."
"I'll do that next time, Bobby Lee." I filled him in on what I'd learned at the police department while we walked down the nearly endless steps that led from the storeroom to the lower parts of the Circus of the Damned. The stairs were wide enough for four people to walk abreast, but the steps themselves were oddly spaced, as if whatever they were originally carved for wasn't very human. They definitely had not been made for bipeds.
"I don't know the name Heinrich," he said.
I looked at him so suddenly that I stumbled and he caught my arm. I realized in that moment that I didn't know much about Bobby Lee. Not really.
"You work for Raphael. You can't be a white supremacist."
He let go of my arm when he was sure I was solidly on one of the odd wide steps.
"Honey child, I'm no white supremacist that specialize in hating people a little darker than Raphael."
"Real Southerners don't say honey child," he grinned at me.
"They do if you northern bastards expect it."
"We're in Missouri. That ain't exactly north."
"It is where I come from."
"And that was?" His smile widened.
"When we're not in the middle of an emergency, we can sit down and share personal time over a beer or coffee. Right now, concentrate, honey child, because we are neck deep and sinking."
"If you don't know Heinrich, then how do you know we're sinking?"
"I was a mercenary before Raphael's people recruited me. I know people like Heinrich."
"What would somebody like that want with me?"
"Well, they were watching you for a reason, Anita. You probably know what the reason is. You just gotta think of it."
I shook my head. "You sound like a friend of mine. He's always telling me that when the shit hits the fan that I should know why the bad guys are after me."
"He's right."
"Not always, Bobby Lee. Not always." But the conversation did make me think of Edward. He'd started out his professional life as a hitman. Then killing humans became too easy, so he switched to monsters. Monsters covered a lot of ground for Edward. No, among the vampires and shapeshifters, he'd include serial killers, snuff film actors, anyone and anything that caught his fancy. Though the price had to be right. Edward didn't work for free. Well, not often. Sometimes he'd work simply for the thrill of chasing something that scared the rest of us mere mortals to death. "Does anyone in Raphael's operation have contacts to non-governmental channels? I don't want anyone owing anyone a favor for this. I don't want anyone getting into trouble. I just want to know what the regular government channels either don't know or aren't sharing with the St. Louis Police Department."
"We have some ex-military special forces, things like that." "I'll ask around."
I nodded. "Good. And I'd call Edward, see if he knew Heinrich." I started walking down the steps again. Bobby Lee fell in beside me, though since he was 6 feet, and I so wasn't, it was probably an awkward stride for him. He didn't complain, and I didn't offer to speed up. I wasn't exactly looking forward to seeing Jean-Claude or Asher again. I still didn't know what to say. We were within sight of the big, heavy door that led to the underground areas. It was partially ajar, waiting for us.
"By the way, Jean-Claude and Asher request your presence in Jean-Claude's room."
I sighed, and my unhappiness must have shown on my face because he touched my arm.
"Don't look so glum, honey. They said something about owing you an apology."
My eyebrows went up at that. An apology? Them owing me? I like the sound of that. I like the sound of that a lot. Chapter 42. It wasn't the apology I was expecting, But under the circumstances, any apology was better than none, especially if I wasn't having to give it. Of course, it took them nearly 5 minutes to get me to hear the apology, because once I got a good look at the two of them in their banquet finery, I was rendered speechless, deaf, and damn near blind to anything else. I don't think it was magic or vampire trickery. They just looked fine. Asher wore a jacket of pale gold with darker gold embroidery and an edge of true metallic gold thread shot through the embroidery itself. There was a touch more gold at collar, lapels, wide cuffs, just enough extra sparkle to mingle with the gold of his hair as it cascaded over his shoulders and add emphasis to the gestures of his hands. His shirt was a foam of white frills at chest and wrist, like a tamed cloud. I knew from rifling through Jean-Claude's closet that the shirt wasn't nearly as soft as it appeared. The pants were the same pale gold as the jacket, with a line of embroidery down either side of his leg. Boots the color of oyster shells graced his legs, their tops folded down just above the knees, tied with pale brown leather belts and small gold buckles, which could be glimpsed as he moved. I noticed Asher first, maybe because of his powers, or maybe because he was all shiny and gold and eye-catching. It was like noticing the sun. You couldn't help but see it, to turn to face the heat of it, to bask in the glory of it. But often when the sun is high in the sky, the moon is up there too. A dim memory of what she will be in the night, but there nonetheless, dim and misty, hard and white. At night there is only the moon. The sun is nowhere to be seen. There are no distractions when the moon rules the night sky. Jean-Claude's coat was a black velvet so soft and fine that it shone like fur. It was opera length, flowing down to his ankles. There was embroidery on the lapels, the wide cuffs, a deep royal blue. The embroidery on the coat matched that on the black vest, but the shirt that showed in all that black and royal was the same shade of blue of the silk sheets on the bed, cerulean blue, a color caught between the skies of day and night. It brought out the blue of his eyes so that they were like living jewels set amid the black of his hair. The near-pure whiteness of his skin. The silk was mounded into soft ruffles at his chest and tucked into the vest. A gold and sapphire stick pin pierced the ruffles at his chest. The stone was almost as large as one of his blue eyes. Cufflinks winked as he gestured. Gold, with sapphires, almost as large as the one on his chest. The sapphires were that cornflower blue, like a drop of Caribbean sea water made solid. His hair was a mass of black curls. It was almost as if he'd done less to it than normal, letting it tousle around his face and shoulders. The black of his hair blended into the black of his coat, so that the hair was like a living accessory. For a moment, I thought he was wearing leather pants, until I realized the black boots ran up the entire length of his leg. He was wearing black pants, but they were barely visible. I got just a flash of the black boots when he moved. The entire length of the boot, from ankle to ass, was tied with blue cord that matched the startling blue of his shirt. I was caught between going, "Yippee skippy, I get to play with them both!" and running like hell. I managed to simply stand there in the middle of the room and not run or fall at the feet like a groupie, though the last part took more determination than I'd ever admit out loud. "Ma petite, have you heard a word that we have said?" I remembered that their mouths had been moving while I gazed at all that masculine splendor. But for the life of me, I couldn't repeat a word of it. I blushed as I admitted, "Not really." He looked exasperated, hands on hips, spreading the coat backwards, flashing more of the blue cord as he paced towards me. "It is as I feared, Asher. She is besotted with you." "If we can't..." He made a waffling motion with his hands, and I saw the sapphire ring for the first time, winking at me in the candlelight. "Tone down this effect, then she will be useless tonight." If I had dreamt that she could be so totally affected, I would have held back. Jean-Claude turned and faced Asher. I could see that there was blue embroidery on the back of the coat. It made a pattern or picture, but I couldn't figure it out through the spill of hair. "Would you, mon ami, would you truly have withheld such pleasure? Could you have resisted?" "If I had known this, I would not have weakened us with Musette and her people here, not for any pleasure." I frowned and shook my head. "Hold it, guys." They turned and looked at me. They both looked surprised, I think because I sounded so normal. This can't be Asher's powers. Not unless his fascination extends to Jean-Claude, because you both seem equally nifty. I feel like jumping up and down and saying, "Yippee, I get to play with them both." I blinked and fought not to blush. "I'm sorry," Did I just say that out loud? The two men exchanged glances. Then Jean-Claude turned back to me, and Asher directed that pale blue gaze on me.
What are you saying, ma petite? I have never seen you stand so speechless and insensible before me.
I looked at the two of them and shook my head. Fine. You need a reminder. I can do that. I walked past them to the full-length mirror that sat on the opposite side of the room. I motioned them both over. Come on, come on. We don't have all night. They finally drifted over to me, looking puzzled. I got a little distracted watching them glide towards me in all that silk and leather and sparkly stuff. But finally, I had them standing in front of the mirror. Though they weren't looking at the mirror, they were looking at me, still puzzled. I finally had to touch each of them lightly on the arm and maneuver them so that the gold cream of Asher's coat spilled against the black velvet of Jean-Claude's, so the black curls intermingled with golden waves. I pushed them together until the startling blue of Jean-Claude's shirt and the sapphire pin brought out the blue of both of their eyes. Look at yourselves and tell me that any mere mortal isn't going to stand there and say, wow, for a few minutes. They looked into the mirror. They looked at each other. And finally, Jean-Claude smiled. Asher didn't.
If it were merely Asher's power, then, you are correct, ma petite, it would not extend to me.
He turned to face me, still smiling.
But I have never seen you this besotted.
You just haven't noticed. He shook his head.
No, ma petite, I would have noticed such a phenomenon before.
I shrugged. Maybe I'd never seen you both dressed to kill before. The double impact is a little overwhelming. He moved away enough to turn in a graceful circle, arms out, showing off the outfit.
You think it is too much?
I smiled and almost laughed. No, not even close. But I'm allowed to stand dumbfounded in the presence of such beauty.
Très poétique, ma petite.
Looking at the two of you, I only wish I was a poet. Because I can't do you justice. You look amazing, wondrous, spec-fucking-tacular. Asher walked to stand at the far end of the room beside the false fireplace. It was hard to see in the dimness, but tonight someone had put two tapered candles on the mantelpiece, each encased in crystal, so they glimmered like jewels. Asher's hair sparkled in the uncertain light. He put one hand on the mantel, his head down to stare at the cold hearth, as if the new fire screen Jean-Claude had added was très fascinating. The fire screen was a huge antique fan encased in glass. The colors were vibrant reds, greens, a brilliant spray of flowers and delicate lace. It was pretty, but not that pretty. I looked at Jean-Claude for some clue, and he merely motioned to me to follow Asher across the room. When I just stood there, Jean-Claude took my hand and led me over to the other man. Asher must have heard his coming, because he said,
"I was very angry with you, Anita. Very angry. So angry I did not think you might have just cause to be angry with me."
Jean-Claude squeezed my hand as if to tell me not to interrupt, but I seemed to be ahead on that decision, so I hadn't planned to say a word. Never interrupt when you're winning.
Jason told us how ill you were after I took blood from you. If you're as ill as he has reported, then you would naturally fear my embrace.
He looked up, suddenly, eyes wide and almost wild, lost in the glow of his hair and the flickering candlelight.
I would not have hurt you. It has never been so.
He seemed to be searching for a word.
Terrible for any of my other...
Again he hesitated.
Victims.
I wasn't sure what to say to that, because I agreed with part of what he'd said. I felt that he'd made me a victim of his powers, by not asking me first. But whether I'd been aware of it or not, somewhere in the back of my mind, I must have been thinking about the problem all damn day, because I knew one thing for certain. I wasn't completely in the right either. Damn it. I let go of Jean-Claude's hand, because the feel of his skin against mine made it harder to concentrate right now. I can see where you might have gotten the idea that I understood what sharing blood with you would mean. I did ask you to bite me. I did offer to feed you, and you were right. I did know that your bite could overwhelm my natural defenses. It was my turn to look down at the pretty fire screen that would never know the touch of flame. I was just so out of my head with... I almost couldn't say it. Desire, that I wasn't thinking clearly. But that wasn't your fault. You could only go with what I said out loud. I looked up, met those eyes. Oh, hell, Asher. Even if you could have read my mind at that moment, I wanted you to take me, whatever that meant. There were no rules or stop signs in my head. I let out a long breath and it shivered, because I was afraid of this, afraid of admitting it out loud, afraid of it all. I was afraid of being consumed by desire, or love, or whatever the hell you want to call it. I wanted you to take me while Jean-Claude made love to me. I wanted us all to be together, as of old. It is not of old for you, Anita, Asher said. He looked past me at Jean-Claude. See, it is as we feared. She is besotted with me through your memories. It is not real what she feels.